Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELEC 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. Seems like you didn't want me to talk football today, Jeff. Bitch about the Eagles for the whole show.
It's Red October.
It is, and you made sure to book
us. It's October. It's red. The city is ready.
You made sure to book us.
Are you?
Wonderful guest. I am ready. I'm excited.
I made sure you were ready.
How'd you do that?
So we're gonna have him on a World Series champion.
How
does it get better than that?
I'm really
a World
excited.
Series champion who will not tell you the sky is falling.
Do you want to wait?
That is my gift to you.
Do you want to wait to bring him on, or do you want to start now and then we'll talk about everything afterwards? Because that's a good way to start the show.
Bring him on.
All right. It's Red October. It's always fun to be joined by World Series champion Greg Dobbs. Greg, less than 24 hours away. Has his Phillies shirt on. I feel like if you could run out on the field tomorrow, you would.
I definitely would, but like I'd probably tear both hamstrings off the bone, right? I don't have it in me anymore. But no, it's this is the most exciting time of the season, right? I mean, this is what Philly lives for. Philly was made for October and for the postseason. So I got to rep my team and got to rep my Phillies Reds.
You know, you had the chance to play for several teams. I was at a game a couple weeks ago, and somebody said something to me that it never crossed my mind, but Philadelphia in the month of October, there's nothing like it. As a player, did you experience the same thing?
Yes. One, it was the only postseasons that I made it to were the 4 years in Philly, but playing against those other teams, right? Whether it was Milwaukee, whether it was coming through LA, right? And playing against the Dodgers in the city that I grew up in, right? That I called home as a young child and still do today. The Yankees, right? Going to play the Yankees in Yankee Stadium in 2009, World Series. Like, there's no environment. Having played in all those other environments, right? And everybody's like, you know, LA, oh, it's such a great environment. No, it's not. New York environment. No, it's not. But there is nothing like our fans, Citizens Bank Park, ringing the bell when it comes into October. There is literally no environment like it out there. And it's a reason why so many teams do not like coming to play us in October. And I can't blame them because we got the 10th man, which is our fans and our stadium.
Talk about what it's like to come to the ballpark as a player, see the playoff logo painted on the field, know the rally towels are going to be in the stand, and see the bunting up around the ballpark. As a fan, I get all juiced up just seeing the bunting up there. What's it like as a player when you get out on that field and it's all there and ready for you?
So, one, it's a long season, right? Like spring training, 20, 30 games, 162. Everybody's spent, right? Everybody's kind of on fumes. It's the biggest shot of adrenaline you ever get besides opening day, right? Or the anticipation of spring training. It's like you walk to the stadium. One, you know what's coming, right? After you experience a couple, you're like, oh man, this is like nothing is better, right? Besides maybe your marriage or the birth of your first child or second child, whatever. There's nothing like that experience and the anticipation of that experience. And so you walk into the park, you walk down the tunnel, the bustling and the movement of all the amazing employees, right? At CBP, right? Just getting everything and all the little trucks and the carts going everywhere and taking stuff. Like it is an energy in and of itself. And I get goosebumps as I tell a story because I literally like reliving walking down that from our players' lot, the tunnel down into the clubhouse, just the smell and the energy. You can sense it in the stadium. And it's 1 o'clock, right? Our game is until 6 or 7. There is nothing like walking to the park, getting there, going out, seeing all the signage, you know, then you've got the reporters, all the reporters now from multiple markets, right, are in the clubhouse, right? Like there's just it is the biggest shot of adrenaline that you could ever experience.
Well, you mentioned adrenaline. The Phillies will have had a week off now. They tried on Wednesday to recreate the adrenaline. They had music. They had the scoreboard on. They tried
playing
each other. they chose teams and it came out to a tie, which is just sad. But does that work? Or and if you were in this situation now, would you want this bye or would you want to keep going, considering the Phillies have had guys that are all dinged up at this point?
It's a great question, and one that I've thought about. You think back to Atlanta, right, the last couple of years, right, and sort of the excuses that they had made or the things that they had said publicly about the having somewhat of a break.
Excuses they've made, and you're right. This year, they didn't get the time off, and that didn't matter either.
You're right. So thank you. So it's all about how do you use that time effectively, right? And time off is great, I think, especially for our club, given where they finished the season, right? Being nicked up, having got, you know, Bryce dealing with the elbow, right? Other guy, Baum, giving his hand and everything just to, you know, some of our pitchers, right? To give them time to just get their bearings, right? They don't have to worry about going out there and competing. They've got 5, 6, 7 days to just get in the training room, get the PT, watch video, let the body just kind of heal itself. So from that perspective, it's been, I think, a plus for us. Now you talk about the adrenaline and how do you replace that? There is no replacement. You can pump music into the stands. You can pump the fan sounds into the stands. You could try to recreate it as best you can, which is what you have to do. I mean, we had to do that a little bit. There were times where I remember one year, you know, Pedro Martinez, when he was with us, right? We didn't know if he was going to be in the rotation or not. We had a couple days off. Me and a couple other guys, I think Bruntlett and a few others, Pedro went out on the mound in CBP, total off day. We had a little bit of a break, and he threw live to some of us so that he could get sharp and we could get sharp. So you're always going to want to do things. I think Rob Thompson, the staff, Dombrowski, everybody has – they're going to do everything that they possibly can, but at the end of the day, you can't replace it, right? And what I loved hearing is listening to Topper. They talked about velo, right, and how they've got the machines and the cages to set up, and the mandatory thing that they wanted their hitters to do was to get into those cages on those machines and face velocity, because one, like adrenaline, it's something that you can't really replace unless you're facing your horses live, right? Like, you're not going to be facing Wheeler, right? Like, they're going to give him a rest, but you can get in on those cages off the machines and you could dial it up to 90, 95, 100, 102. That, to me, that's genius. And that's something that actually we would do back in our years of 7, 8, 9, and 10, was we'd get in there and we'd dial that sucker up, right? Especially if we knew we're going to be facing some horses that are really going to be bringing it. We'd absolutely do that because that's just preparing you. And I think they're doing as good a job as they possibly can. But there's just no replacement for that sense. When that park is jam-packed with almost 50,000 people, it's hard to replace.
How does that work with the pitching? So what they said they were doing was having a machine throw 100 miles an hour from 50 feet. So what does that do for you? Doesn't that screw up your timing?
Well, it can if you're going to be facing a guy that's throwing 88 to 90. But the thought is, you can never have enough time, right? And if you can train yourself and you train your eyes and your swing and your timing to be able to catch up and perfectly time 100 miles an hour from 50 feet, 55 feet, you know, 60 feet, 6 inches, that gives you so much confidence as a hitter. That makes 88 look like it's 82, or makes 94 looks like it's like 88, right? And as a hitter, if you know that I can time up 100 miles an hour no problem at 55 feet or 50 feet, mentally I got it. Like, I have nothing to worry about as a hitter. No one's gonna get it by me. So I think personally, having done it myself and being a big believer and proponent of it, it truly helps. And it helps because also too, think about the staffs that you're going to see in the postseason. They've got guys that are running it up there, right? So I think it's a great benefit.
Can it make them stay disciplined and not chase too? Like, I get that it'll keep them up, but, and I say that sarcastically because, you know, I'm a loser fan, so I just keep watching highlights of previous years. Jeff knows this. I mean, I admit it. We own what we are.
He's
on this
show.
I am very much, but like, I watched the Chase Utley at bat where he got Ryan Howard to the plate to tie that game in 2009. I watched the Brett Myers at bat where he was so disciplined against CC Sabathia and the crowd went crazy. Are like, that's, you need discipline in the playoffs as much as you need aggressiveness. So like, that's my concern with this lineup is in the past, we've seen them too aggressive where, you know, they don't, the opposing teams don't throw anything over the plate. They just throw a bunch of slop and let them chase further and further out where Jeff gets on the show with me and just loses his mind over Castellano swinging over a pitch that's in New Jersey, basically. So how do we, like, what's the balance there between, as a hitter, wanting to be aggressive at the plate and being able to catch up to the fastball, but at the same time knowing that that aggressiveness can be used against you by the other team too?
Great point. Great question.
Of course, using Brett Myers as your example,
fine,
that's a little rough. We have a guy who is a professional hitter, and you're using Brett Myers as your example.
But that was
go ahead, Greg.
That was a 10-pitch at bat against CC Sabathia, where he fouled pitches off, and so like that's what you need in the playoffs. You need to outlast the pitcher, not just, you know, hit the fastest pitch when it comes. You got to hit the ball.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm loving all this. I would correct you. Not, you don't have to outlast the pitcher.
True.
You have to hit his mistakes and take the pitches that he and the catcher want you to chase.
Yeah.
Right. Or pitches that are not in the strike zone. So to get back to your original question of discipline, hitting off of a machine at velocity does also help with discipline if you are also working on that at the same time, right? Where it's just not, I'm not blindly swinging at every pitch that comes out of that machine. Some of those pitches aren't going to be perfect. Some of them will, if a ball is scuffed, it's going to go up and to the right, you know, down and to the left, you know, sink, rise, whatever. It's not going to just put it right there, like over your wallet, if you sat it in the middle of home plate, no chance, right? So what we would work on as well was taking pitches, right? Like, yes, adjusting to velocity and being able to handle and deliver the barrel to the velocity consistently, but also too, if you work on recognizing at velocity, if it's a ball or a strike as well. And that all then gets me to game plan. And my hitting coach that I had my entire career, who I started with 14 years old, a gentleman named Mike Stubbins, who's since passed, God rest his soul. He kept it very simple for me. And one of his mantras was, and I preach this still to this day, is number one, good pitch. Number two, good stroke. Let the result take care of itself. And it usually does if you follow that order. First, get a good pitch. So when we talk about discipline with adrenaline flowing in the postseason, which it's going to, right? And guys are going to chase. We're human, we're infallible, we're going to do it. But if your focus is, and I know Kay Long is really good at this, is developing a game plan. What zones are we going to attack? What zones are we not going to attack, right? Laying off pitches that are borderline up, right? They look good, they're cookies. We used to call them cookies, right? Like, that cookie looks really good, but you can't go after it, right? You can't. It all comes down to approach and get back to just getting a good pitch. And when you get that good pitch, you put the best swing you can on it. So discipline, I would say, is at a premium as well.
How much will the start time of the game impact that? You know, obviously fans are going to have a blast. The 4 o'clock start on a Saturday and Sunday, they've got all the time in the world to prepare for the game. But as a player, you got to deal with the shadows at that point. So, you know, generally that's kind of advantage pitcher when the hitter can't see what's coming at him earlier on in the game. What's the challenge for a player in a 4 o'clock start versus a 1 o'clock or 7 o'clock start?
Yeah, we hated it. We literally hated it because one, we're creatures of habit and schedule, right? Like, it's either a 1 o'clock game or it's a 6:40 or it's a 7:05 or it's a 6:05, right? And the odd the odd game time. In the postseason, TV scheduling and TV rights rule it, right? Everybody knows that, which is why you get that 4 o'clock or that 3:35 start where you've never started a game at that time. Shadows can be super tough. The thing is, both teams, both offenses have to deal with it, right? So you try your very, very best to battle through it, to deal with the shadows, knowing that the other club's got to deal with it too. And then once you get to that, you know, witching hour of maybe 5 o'clock, right, where the sun has gotten behind, you know, Citizens Bank, and now you don't have a shadow from the center field wall, the stadium lights now are really working well and really lighting up the infield, or the entire field. You just got to grit and bear it, and that's where you really have to hunker down on your pitch selection and plate discipline. Like, you really, really do, because you're already at a slight disadvantage. The biggest thing about shadows is it throws off a hitter's depth perception. You can see it out of the hand more often than not, but with those shadows, it messes with the hitter's depth perception. And when your depth perception is being toyed with, your timing is usually going to be off. So what I did was, knowing that, I spread myself out a little bit, my base that is, where I kind of took my stride away just a little bit so that I didn't worry so much about timing. I just know I've got to focus on really picking up this ball a quarter of the way from the pitcher's mound to home plate, because I know I'm dealing with shadows. So I didn't want to have to worry about my step getting down and my timing. I just like, I'm going to take one thing out of the equation, get wide, get my base. And now all I'm worried about is just seeing the ball as best as I possibly can. It's tough. But you know what? Both teams got to deal with it.
You know, this season seems different than the last couple. There was momentum going into the playoffs, even though the record didn't reflect it, as opposed to this year when they won the division for the first time since I believe you were there. And there's this concern in Philadelphia, maybe you can make everyone feel a little bit better, that this team doesn't have that mojo, that there's something missing, even though they seem like the most complete team in the playoffs.
Well, if you harken back to those years, we did have great momentum going into, you know, one, clinching the East, and then going into the NLDS and the NLCS. So I think everyone having that really fresh in their minds and their memory, now they're comparing that, and also to the last few years, right, where we've maybe not had the greatest momentum. Maybe we have, and we get in as a wild card. I think, one, raising that 2024 NL East flag, like that gives you some really good momentum and juice, right? Like, okay, having to deal with some injuries there, guys getting being banged up, but still getting out there because these guys are freaking warriors and soldiers, right? Like, I hear what fans say, and I understand. I'm not saying they're wrong. What I'm saying is, having been in that clubhouse and experienced it, varying degrees of momentum running into our postseasons, it's a whole new game. It's a whole new game. I mean, it's October. And so those lights go on and it's game on, right? And you create your own momentum from the first pitch, from the first play, from the first at bat. And that's what I want to see our Phillies do. I want to see them set the tone, which I am sure they will, and I'm sure this is something they've spoken about, is you set the tone from the very first pitch. Actually, even before the first pitch, it's all about, and I know these guys are so good at doing it, how they carry themselves, their body language, what they're saying in interviews, what they're saying to each other in the clubhouse, right? Like, there's two types of momentum. There's one momentum that is on the field, right, that is somewhat tangible. We all see it's in the record, it's in the numbers. There's a different type of momentum that is built and that is fostered with the club, in the work that they're doing in the cages, in the bullpen, right, in this off time that they've had now to the season, and now going into their first series, whether momentum every day in that clubhouse too. And that's what I think a lot of fans don't maybe realize.
Is that why Schwarber actually works? We've had this discussion for seasons now about Kyle Schwarber and what is he doing leadoff.
Jeff's lost this fight.
I'm now sold on it. And listening to you talk, I'm sitting there going, is that it? Is this guy is a veteran's veteran? This guy is a leader's leader. He's done it on multiple teams. Is having him there to set this tone going into the playoffs versus even just the regular season, is that why it works?
No question. No question. Guys like Schwarb are irreplaceable. They're special. They're special teammates. They're special humans. And he fits that mold to a T. You've got to have guys like that, right? Like, you got to have guys that are going to command the attention and respect of not only the younger guys in the clubhouse, but even guys that are 5-6 years in, or even the other veterans that are there, right? And someone who can effectively police and challenge and support and celebrate and do it all very easily, as though he was born to do it. That, I mean, there's no secret. That's one of the big components to the success of this team since we acquired him, is he's that guy. And there's other guys there too that do it. I mean, look at Hartford, right? Like, very stoic, the quiet leader, right? But there's a presence there, and you can't help but feel it, right? It's sort of like when we had Jimmy, and then we had Chase, right? Chase, stoic, quiet, like, but presence. And he would just give us a look, or you could tell by the pace that he was walking, and like, ooh, there's some intent there, like, and it kind of like fired you up a little bit. He didn't have to say anything, because he really didn't, right? But then you had Jimmy, who was more the outgoing, you know, team, or the team to beat, right? You just throw it out there, challenge us. It's a beautiful thing about this team, you know, and as, you know, Mr. Middleton and everybody have started to form this team, and we're putting their DNA and their thumbprint on it going back, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. You know, I remember having conversations with Mr. Middleton to say, you're building that again, aren't you? I can see you. I can see what you're creating here, because it's very reminiscent of what we had. And to his credit, you know, I was like, oh no, Greg, your teams were, you were just an impeccable group of individuals. And I go, okay, but there's still impeccable groups of individuals out there, right? Like, yes, we were special in our own right, but I see what you're doing here. They're doing it. They're absolutely doing it.
What's it like? I know every player's, you know, manager, everybody says one game at a time. Is there a difference as a player for a 5-game series versus a 7-game series in the way you approach it?
No. You still, your mindset is, you cannot get too ahead of yourself. You cannot think too far down the road, whether it's a 3-game, 5-game, 7-game series. It truly is in the postseason, who executes every pitch, who executes every defensive play, who executes offensively, moving runners, passing the baton. And that is like, you got to be right there in the moment. You have to be thinking, I'm not thinking about the next inning. I'm not thinking about 7 innings from now or 4 or 5 games from now. It's actually more than one game at a time. It's one pitch at a time. It's one at bat at a time, because they're all so important. There's so much weight on every pitch, every play, every at bat, that we even focused it down even finer, right? Like, one game at a time. No, it was one at bat, one pitch, one inning, right? And so that helped us really sort of define it. And it also helped us understand that the team that can execute in the postseason is usually the team that wins.
What's that first at bat like in the World Series?
It was equally as nerve-wracking as my first at bat in the big leagues, when I broke in with Seattle in September of 2004. Exciting, nervous. I mean, my first one was it was James Shields, Big Game James in Tampa, at the Trop. And that place was loud. Yeah, the cowbells they got there. I mean, it's tired. You're swinging a cow. Like, what? We're not on a farm. Like, where are the cows at? Stop with the cowbells. But it was exciting. It was nerve wracking. Like, you just feel, you know, you just that sense of that, just that slight sense of like nervousness and excitement, you know, where are my legs just fully under me right now? I really want them to be, but I feel they're there, but are they there? It's a great feeling. It's a great feeling. I don't think I could properly describe it.
I just
do you talk yourself down as you're walking to the plate? They announce your name. Are you able to say to yourself, calm down?
You are, but
yeah.
Does it work?
Sometimes your body just doesn't listen. Yeah, no. It's like how, you know, like very few people, you know, like maybe Bryce or Schwarbs, you know, or Stott, you know, Stott just seems so cool and collected and calm. Guys like Chase maybe could do that, right? But they were, you know, Jimmy had that, right? In the moment, like Jimmy could just be cool as a cucumber, right? Chase as well. It's tough. It's really tough, but you have to tell yourself that, right? And getting back to executing, you have to do the things as a player. If you're whatever situation you're put into, you have to remind yourself and stay focused on the task at hand and not get caught up, which is so hard to do when all the energy, the excitement, the adrenaline, and the moment, you've got to just, this is baseball. You got to remind yourself this, it's still the same game. Well, it's just like spring training.
I just have one non-Phillies question and then we'll let you go. Jeff will ask a follow-up before we let you go, but you had Charlie Manuel, who believed in his guys. He went to war with his guys and he let you battle through situations. Jeff might have tried to blow up my phone the other day with AJ Hinch having five pitchers in six innings for the Tigers. What would you do as a player if you saw a manager walking out to the mound that many times in a game?
Ooh, well, one, do your very best to not show up your manager first and foremost, because cameras are everywhere. And the red light's always on somewhere. But just be like, really? You know, they brought in Job and they're like, I was watching the game and I'm like, okay, this kid's got what? Like five innings in the big leagues? Like high leverage situation in Houston? Bring him in, like, and I'm thinking to myself, oh man, what a tall task. This poor kid. I don't care if you throw a million, okay? Tough task. Okay, come out twice, three times. All right. Like there's a rhythm to the game too, right? Like
not when he's managing.
that's AJ. Okay. Like him or love him or hate him. Like that's AJ. And it works sometimes, as it did there, sometimes you're just there and you're like, and Chuck was so good at this too. And Rich Doobie, who we had as our pitching coach, like they had such a great sense of timing and the situation and the scenario and the guys too. Like they were so quick that our staff those years knew our players so well, sometimes better than they knew themselves. And so they could tell just by watching and looking, either one, he's got it, we got to pull him, or two, like, hey, no, we're going to stick with you. Right. And I only need one visit to do it. It can wear on you a little bit. I'm trying to be kind. It can wear on you a little bit because you're like, hey, we're losing a little momentum here, right? I get it. We're trying to win, but like, hey, sometimes
Jeff's not a player or Jeff's not a player or fan of the team, and it wears on him. He hasn't texted me that much in a game in a while.
I'm just not a fan of the opener. It's game two. It wasn't game seven where your pitchers are all worn out. They have to have a second starter that can go five, six.
No, they
seven
traded
innings.
Their second starter at the deadline and didn't think they were going to make it. Their roster, it's unbelievable. Their whole postseason roster makes $18 million in total. There are 62 baseball players who make more than that. They eliminated off Josh Hader, who makes $19 million a year alone. That's what the Tigers are doing right now.
It's insane, actually. It's in, like we talk about
it's
stories.
Cool, though.
It is cool. Yeah. It's great. And this is why everybody loves baseball. They had because right?
They had a 0.2% chance to make the playoffs on August 10th. They were 55-63. They're 33-11 since.
What about KC?
Same thing. KC. Yeah, take out the Orioles.
Take like you look at the Orioles. Yes, like so many great stories, and it just shows you there's maybe a few ways you could skin a cat, right? Like, you know, like you can get there multiple ways, and with different styles. But for me, what's really great, one, first, our Phillies are back in the postseason. We're back on top, winning the NL East, where we belong. But then also too, just the rest of the league, and how this postseason is filled out with the teams. Some really great stories out there.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot. I have a bottle of Cooperstown whiskey right here in a baseball jar. Am I going to get to open this and celebrate this at the end of the season?
Yes, you are. Yes.
Ooh, confidence.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So,
yes. So I'm going to leave it there.
So whenever I text Jeff with my anxiety during the playoffs, he's just going to clip this segment of you saying to get there to calm me down.
That's right.
Like it's day of saying calm down. It's just going to be a text from Dobbs saying, yes, we're going to make it. That's
just guys, just we'll start a text chain. So then there's no, we'll take the middleman out. Like put me in it.
Okay.
Anyone needs talking off a ledge, I'm here.
I'm going to warn you because Jeff doesn't have to. You don't want to be on a text message chain with me during a game. You really don't.
He's stream of conscious.
I will take it if you want it. But I mean, Jeff regrets ever giving me his cell phone number, let alone the fact that we do a radio show together when it comes to game time.
Wow.
Greg Dobbs, always
Jeff
a blast.
Adamant. Jeff.
Yeah, he's got opinions. Don't let him fool you. Greg Dobbs, we always appreciate getting to break it down with you. It's going to be fun to watch. We will talk to you as the playoffs go on.
Can't wait, guys. Great to see you, boys. Go Phils.
So clearly you have how you're going to handle me for the playoffs now when I'm losing my mind with anxiety, right?
Isn't that preferred, the way that I handled it?
Do you think that I handled it the right way by letting him know that he really didn't want to be on a text message chain with me? Like, I don't want to ruin a guest that we have because he sees the real me.
For people don't know, we have the ability to see each other, our guests. So I think he saw my facial reaction.
You know, he definitely, he threw
there
it
was
out
a
there.
Lot of, because Greg at one point said, based on what Jeff's saying, maybe not.
So I'm going to give a little secret to it. We also talked to Greg about other things before the show, and I think you decided that you'll moderate our conversations, right? You'll decide what is okay for Greg to see of my lunacy as a fan.
Yes, I'm going to share with him some of the Jason's best or worst, depending on how you say it, and we'll see what he says to those.
All right. Well, last night you seemed to be counting the Mets out, and they looked lifeless for a bit, and then I saw something this morning. I don't know whether Williams was tipping his pitches or not, but Alonso with a blast that changes everything for the Mets, and they're coming to Philly now.
And he could have been – when I texted you, so just for context, Francisco Lindor, I believe, had all of the hits, which was two for seven
in
innings.
In seven innings, yes.
And in the
kind of like a Phillies game that I lose my mind over. Where
was it the bottom of the seventh or by the bottom of the eighth? I can't remember. I think it was the bottom of the seventh when the Brewers hit back-to-back home runs.
Yes.
Followed by getting two men on base. Followed by finally being able to get out of the inning on a pop fly to Alonso, who dropped the ball.
Yes.
And at that moment, I texted you because I went, they just don't care anymore. Like, you can't miss that. And then Alonso comes back and ends up being the hero by launching that pitch.
What a crazy game. I mean, you can't make up these playoff scripts. You really can't. If somebody, like, would give this to a script, they would say, really? That's going to happen?
Yeah, but that's what should scare you. See, that's why I'm surprised that you are not looking up instead of looking at me, looking for the sky falling, because what the Mets have right now is the momentum of the Phillies from 2 years ago.
I am uneasy that they are the hot team with nothing to lose. I think the Phillies are the better team if they play the way they can, but you and I have talked all season about our concerns about them doing that. And with this lineup, they'll face a lot of lefties. You know, if they would have faced the Brewers, they would have faced a lot of righties. Brewers have a better bullpen, but they got a lot of righties in that lineup. Now, all of a sudden, a lot of lefties. You're going to see a lot of matchups, Thompson making moves to try to do that. So, I mean, you're already adjusting to what the other team is doing.
Guess who's going to be playing right field now?
Who's that, Hayes?
Or, I mean, left field, yeah. Hayes.
Yeah, Hayes will be out there in left field. Look, I don't know if... Who do you put in center? Marcia Rojas with a lefty. Like, they've kind of flipped it
really? You have a question about that?
Well, I think they're going to put Marsh out there.
Why? Against lefties?
Because he's more comfortable with Marsh.
Against lefties?
You think he puts Rojas out there against
I'll
lefties?
I'll blow my mind if that happens.
You think he puts Rojas out there at lefty? They haven't played Rojas as much. I know he wasn't feeling great, but down the stretch, if you look, he didn't get as many games. So I don't know what their plan is right now.
We've had this discussion before. You and I have had this discussion on air. How does it make sense against a lefty to put in a guy who can't hit, who's a worse fielder than Rojas?
I have told you I would have the best defensive lineup. Rojas to me.
But it's the better offensive lineup too. Marsh cannot hit lefties.
I agree. We'll see, though. I anxiously await your text message when the lineups are released.
Logan Mohapi probably.
God. At like 1-2 o'clock tomorrow, I can't wait till the lineups are released and you are not satisfied with who is in them.
Well, who do you think is starting for the Mets? We know it's Wheeler for the Phillies, but who do you think is starting for the Mets?
McGill, who was going to start. I forget who was going to start. They're because they had to pitch Peterson to close last night, so he probably won't be game one. Mm-hmm. I think it's more interesting what the Phillies end up doing with their game two starter.
I think you may be right. I think it may be Sanchez.
Yeah, I mean, you want to put your strongest pitchers out there, but at the same time, do you want Nola the veteran going in game three at Citi Field, or do you want Sanchez and his, you know, in that atmosphere?
What we should have done is had somebody check out the stats for Aaron Nola pitching in Citi Field.
Well, if we had a good researcher, then we could do that, but your son's busy these days. He's taking you to baseball games and stuff. So
I know. What can I tell you?
You know, we'll have to work on that. But, I mean, look, of course I'm nervous. I'm a Phillies fan. Like, I wouldn't be a Phillies fan if I wasn't nervous. But, and I probably would have preferred to play the Brewers. I've told you that all along. I think the Mets are just a hot team. But I don't think that means that the Phillies can't win. I mean, you have Wheeler going in two starts.
Well, if it makes you feel better... I did pull up the stats. Okay. Aaron Nola pitched one game in New York this year. It was May 14th, and won it.
Yeah.
He had 8 strikeouts, pitched a complete game, 4 hits, no runs.
Yeah, I mean, I've said that to you. I will not be surprised at all if Sanchez is the number two.
Last year, not so good. Last year, he pitched one game in New York, and he went 5 strikeouts, 6 innings, 4 runs. So it's a mixed bag.
I saw somebody tweet this morning, America's not ready for Phillies-Mets division series in South Jersey, where you have interstate Wawa system at risk of collapse. Strategic Hoagie and Tanning Oil Reserve will be severely stressed. We may never know peace again. So I know you have your thoughts about X, but it exists solely for series like this.
I can assure you, though, there will not be many Mets fans there, unlike the regular season.
I hope not.
I don't think there's
prices are going to be tickets. Really expensive.
Have you already done? How do you not have that statistic at your fingertips?
Well, they were 200 plus before the Mets,
right?
Were the opponent. So let's check the get in price this afternoon on Ticketmaster. Let's go to the Phillies. Why don't you say something profound while I look it up?
I'm looking it up for you.
Okay, you're looking it up. Well, so we're both doing research on the air. This is awesome radio.
Right now, it's $276 for standing room only tickets.
That's the get-in price.
Yes, the cheapest ticket for sitting down on your butt is $315.
How much are your tickets? You're not selling them, you're going, but how much are your tickets? I mean,
they were like $110.
I know what they were, but they're probably going for $500.
I have no idea. I don't care.
You don't. You'll be
there. There's no reason for me to look because there's no price that I'm giving them up for.
All right. Why don't we hit the break and then let's talk about the impact that Dikembe Mutombo had, and then we'll close up.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
Sad news this week as Dikembe Mutombo passed away at the age of 58 from cancer. Let's welcome senior writer for Anscape, Mark Spears, to the show, who wrote this week about his lasting legacy. Mark, thanks for joining the show.
No, my pleasure, man. Anytime Jesse Washington says, these are some good people, you got to talk to them. You know,
We love talking to Jesse, and we wish it was we got to talk to you on a better topic. It's not often that you
That's
have
a great topic, though. It's a great man.
And it is. And it's not often you have somebody who, when they pass away, everybody from the Special Olympics to a former president to the head of the NBA to teams comment on the impact he had. Can you talk about the man that was Dikembe Mutombo?
Yeah, he's a superman. Obviously, people most notably know him for what he did with the game of basketball. He's a second all-time shot block leader, former Georgetown Stars, jersey's retired with the Nuggets, and, you know, with the Atlanta Hawks. You know, who could forget the video moment where he's on the ground, eyes closed, smiling, clenching the basketball above his head after the Nuggets, you know, shocked the top seed Sonics, which probably was his signature, like, moment picture-wise, right? But how could you not forget the finger wag, right, with all the shot blocks? And I've seen some incredible video the last couple of days of shot blocking Sean Kemp or shot blocking Clarence Witherspoon. And just he was, you know, incredible and intimidating in that regard. But for me, you know, what stood out to me is what he did off the court, you know, how he used his platform to basically bridge America and Africa from a basketball and a humanitarian standpoint. I mean, you're talking about a guy that built a hospital in his hometown in the Congo, you know, in tribute of his mother who passed away and had some health issues and didn't, I don't think, have the hospital to help her. He also built a school in his hometown. He's basically, in terms of bridging the gap between the NBA and Africa for basketball purposes, there's been nobody bigger. All the former, current and former African stars kind of see him now as like the godfather of Africa. He's the one that really pushed the NBA to, you know, start the Basketball Africa League. And he just, you know, he even did things that probably didn't get as much publicity. Turns out, like, if you love coffee, man, go buy some Mutombo coffee. You can buy it online. And I don't even know if you guys know about Mutombo coffee. It's actually pretty good. I'm a big coffee person. So I actually just bought another bag after he passed, and I bought a Mutombo coffee sweater.
Well, and with the Mutombo coffee, he sourced the beans from African coffee farms from participants in the Women in Coffee Initiative.
Yeah.
So he even, you know, making coffee, he had a larger purpose in what he was doing there.
Yeah. Yeah, he brought in female farmers from Africa, and I think some from Latin America as well, that, you know, weren't getting publicized otherwise. So he just was somebody that put his arms around the whole world and definitely made it a better place while he was here.
You know, Mark, you wrote an article this week in Anscape, which was really lays out the man. You started it with the Basketball Hall of Famer unselfishly made his native Africa and the entire world a better place before he died. What was the journey? What I'm interested in is the journey from college to the pros. First off, with having John Thompson. You know, we've had Jesse Washington on before to talk about his book about John Thompson. What was the influence that John Thompson had on Dikembe Mutombo?
Yeah, I mean, interesting, in 87, Dikembe came over from Africa in hopes of becoming a doctor, and he had like a USAID scholarship. I played a season at the University of District of Columbia, which is the HBCU in D.C., and I've heard people from UDC say, well, he was supposed to actually play basketball here. not at Georgetown, but he ended up at Georgetown, and basically John Thompson took him under his wing. And John Thompson is a former teammate of Bill Russell, right? So I think in Dikembe, he saw a taller version of Bill Russell. You know, somebody could rebound and block shots. I mean, Dikembe ultimately ended up getting like a mid-range jumper and had that long winding hook that took about 2 minutes to get off. But I think that's what John Thompson did for him. It's like, big fella, we need you to rebound. We need you to block shots. Don't worry about the offensive end. If you handle this defensive end, you know, it could make you a lot of money for a long time. And, you know, he mastered that, became a high draft pick in 1991 by the Denver Nuggets. And I don't know that if he goes anywhere else, not to say that, you know, obviously North Carolina, Duke, UCLA had, you know, they all across the country, they had notable programs. But I don't know that if he didn't have John Thompson in his corner, if he would have became the player he was. Maybe he had just been another tall African dude from the late 80s who, you know, never turned around. Because they had a lot of African guys that came over at that time that certainly didn't have an ounce of success that Dikembe did. But I think that was certainly a blessing from God for him to be matched with John Thompson, because he not only built him into a shot-blocking menace, but also strengthened him as a person as well. And they had a father-son relationship in the same way that Dikembe would later have with David Stern.
You know, you mentioned David Stern, and – oh, sorry, go ahead, Jeff. You go ahead.
Well, you mentioned the draft and David Stern, and you wrote a lot about in your article about David Stern and his influence and the vision that David Stern had for Dikembe Mutombo. Can you talk a little bit about that vision that he had and the relationship that David Stern had from the moment the draft happened?
Yeah, after Dikembe was drafted in 91, David Stern actually pulled him aside and said, "Hey, I'd like to go to Africa with you," and which certainly piqued, you know, Dikembe's interest, that somebody of that stature in NBA cared. So in, I believe in 94, they did go to South Africa. And, you know, David Stern was certainly ahead of his time in trying to get, you know, the NBA in on TVs globally. I remember he basically gave the NBA to CCTV in China in the late 80s, and always had exhibitions in Europe, and even flirted with the possibility of putting NBA teams in Europe. So Africa, the continent, the mammoth place, was certainly of attraction to him. And, you know, he met Nelson Mandela with Dikembe and, you know, started, I think, building the foundation to having the Basketball Africa League, Basketball Without Borders in Africa, and also was some NBA Africa games as well.
He became so much larger than the game. We got to see him towards his end of his career in that Sixers run that they had with Allen Iverson in 2001. We got to see the finger wag here and the stadium go crazy on the block. I found it interesting. He had said that basketball was a vehicle that I used to get me where I'm going in a Sports Illustrated article in 2022. My inspiration in life is to improve the living condition of my people. The relationship between Stern and Mutombo, they both wanted things. They became very close. Stern wanted to expand in Africa. Mutombo wanted to raise awareness about the Congo and raise money into it. Can you talk about how they really were the perfect pairing, separate from what they were able to do outside of it, how that relationship enabled everything else to happen?
Like, somebody in New York may beg to differ, but I don't know that there was an NBA player that Stern was closer with than Dikembe. In 2009, Stern made Dikembe the first global ambassador for the NBA. That's a huge appointment, and there's countless players he could have chosen, but he chose Dikembe. And I remember Dikembe basically calling him, like, viewed Stern like he was his father. You know, they were really, really close. And in fact, I remember, like, 2017, the Basketball Africa League had like a tryout camp in Brooklyn. And Dikembe was there, And it was around Christmas time, 2017. The announcement of the Basketball Africa League had come months earlier during Charlotte All-Star Weekend, and Dikembe was really emotional when that announcement was made. And apparently David Stern was having like a birthday party, I mean, a Christmas party or something in New York. And Dikembe goes, "Yes, Mark, I'm going to that party tonight just to see David scare people. Everybody is scared of David. And I'm just going there to watch people be in fear." Yeah, so no, they loved each other. And Dikembe told me this story, man. It has to be true. But he swore it was true, and it's a real hard story to lie about. But apparently when his father passed in Congo, there was a civil war going on, so Dikembe couldn't go out there. But they wanted to do a funeral for his father, and they wanted his brother to attend, but it was dangerous for his brother to go from one part of the Congo to the next. So apparently after Dikembe told him about this, David Stern was able to get a somehow – I don't know how, I don't know who he called, what general he called in Congo, whatever, but he was able to get a ceasefire for like 4 hours in the Congo, and was able to get a car service for Dikembe's brother, have him picked up by a boat, taken across the river to the other side where another car picked him up so he can attend some funeral services for their father. And then after the funeral service was over, the car service and the boat service, you know, return Dikembe's brother to back home. And then the war started over like shortly after it. This all happened. Now, I said, "Come on, Dikembe, that ain't, come on, man. That is true, Mark. It's a true story. I promise you it happened." But I mean, hey, man, that's a testament to how much David Stern loved Dikembe and the kind of just deep, deep connections that David Stern has. Because, I mean, you can get a ceasefire at a war in the Congo, boy, you got some connections. I wish I knew him when I was trying to get in the clubs. I'd have called David Stern. He'd have got me into every club, but I was standing in line.
You're just trying to get in the front door.
Yeah.
You know, when you tell stories of Dikembe Mutombo, you see the smile on your face as you tell them. And that's the reaction you get from anyone who talks about Dikembe. And he didn't have it easy as a young kid. And coming over from the Congo, having a father who I don't think made more than $37 a week. It wasn't easy, but what was it about him character-wise that always saw the good, that brought out the joy, that a guy who was as imposing physically as he was seemed to make everybody feel welcome?
You know, he had a very infectious personality, and he never made you feel like he was bigger than you, even though he was bigger than you physically, or better than you, or, you know, he just was like every time he saw you, he'd have a smile. In fact, he would chastise you if you didn't go say hi. "Mark, you haven't said hello to me yet. Why are you taking so long?" You know, one time I was on a flight with him from JFK to Dakar, Senegal. And I remember before the flight, like, everybody at the gate wanted a picture, wanted a video, finger wag video, or a picture of the finger wag, right? They wanted an autograph. They wanted to hug him. And he obliged everyone, you know? Didn't fatigue, didn't get tired of it. He enjoyed being Dikembe Mutombo and took pride in it and realized, like, how important that 2 minutes were to a lot of people. Now, I've seen a lot of athletes just keep their headphones on, keep walking, maybe chastise somebody who's, you know, maybe their timing wasn't the best or whatever. The best person I ever seen as being gracious to fans was Muhammad Ali. And I would say Mutombo was right next to him. And he certainly is was just love people. Love to smile, love to have a good time. I remember being at a Basketball Africa League game in Dakar, and they have this band, this infectious band, and I posted a video of it that just, you know, played thunderous music on drums and with trumpets, but they danced the entire game. And after the game was over, even though they lost, they just kept going, which just showed me a lot about their spirit. Like, even when we lose, we fight on and we enjoy life. And Kembe was right there dancing with a man, just having the best time, and just seeing the smile and the brightness in his eyes and just the joy in his life, you know, certainly makes me appreciate every day that I have on this earth.
Well, in each of those days, you have Jesse Washington. So we got to ask you before you go, who's won the last basketball game you guys have played?
Oh,
I ain't played in a long time, man. I ain't slim and trim like Jesse, man. You know what it is? I would love to hoop. I would love to go out there and hoop half court, full court. I get on an exercise bike every day. And so I think I could physically do it. I'm just too scared of getting hurt, man.
I'm with you.
I'm too scared of blowing out my knee. I'm too scared of blowing out my Achilles.
A hamstring.
And I tore my patella tendon like 7 years ago. So if you can guarantee me I won't get hurt, I'll play Jesse one-on-one.
I can't guarantee you, but maybe a game of horse next time the two of you are in the same.
He'll beat me in horse. He's much. I shot 65%. My last year in college for a reason. Everything was within 5 feet.
Look, we can talk to you.
He'll beat me a horse, but when I did play, he couldn't guard me on the block. No possible way.
We could talk to you all day about this stuff. We know you got lots of work to get back to. Senior writer for Anscape, Mark Spears, thanks for giving us some time and giving us the story about the man that Dikembe was.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Take care now.
You have a great
day. Thanks a lot, Mark.
All right, bye-bye.
So glad you could get Mark Spears on to talk about the impact, not just on the court, but of the man, Dikembe Mutombo.
I'm just going to tell you a quick secret. I tried for a while to get Dikembe Mutombo on our show because he truly was an inspiration to me. And every time we talk about the heart of sports, he was the person that I thought of. And so I'm glad that we had somebody on here to talk about him who knew him.
That's going to be the last word for this week. Go Phillies. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.